This is Phil Farron.
And I am driving home. Couldn't get the key in the lock there for a minute. Okay, so just wrapped up my first month of being semi-retired. I'm starting to settle in. I really am starting to kind of settle into the new schedule. And it's, you know, it's getting into a rhythm and seeing how much we can get done in the time that I actually have. This month is a little interesting because we ended up at 5 weeks as opposed to 4 weeks. So the billing is going to be more on time than was expected. So because of that, it's over 80 hours as opposed to being over 64 hours. But, you know, that's some months fall that way. So that's all fine and good. So, but tonight or this weekend, I'll go ahead and get my billing done on that at the new rates. And then we'll see what goes from there. So it's been a good week. We've been able to get some things done. It really has been a week that I think is going to be representative of the weeks to come. And that is, I get in, I see how many meetings I have, and it pretty much just goes back to back to back to back to back to back to back. And I help out where I help out, and then when I get some extra time, I go run across to the small few little things that I need personally to be doing. We get those knocked out and then move to the next thing, move to the next thing, move to the next thing. So it's actually a much faster pace because the time is compressed. So, you know, which is fine. I don't mind at all. It makes the day goes quickly and, you know, it's good. It's good. Working on book 23 still. This week, I'm right on target for the writing, so that's good, because last week, got out of town on the weekend, and so that threw off the writing enough that I didn't hit my words last week, but I knew that was coming. My poor beloved, I'll get to that in a minute. But anyways, so writing is going good. I still have a few little questions in my mind about, have I left myself enough space to get this done in the target, which is 150,000 words? Do I have too much space? You know, I'm on chapter 23 now, I think, 23. And I normally go to about 30 chapters plus an epilogue, or chapter 30 is usually the last news and memo chapter, because we have little emails that are written, in essence, back and forth between parties, and then there's press releases and things. Those are all kind of done usually in chapter 30, and then we have an epilogue, so we actually end up somewhere around 31, 32 chapters, usually somewhere in there. And I'm on 23, and I have plenty of story to tell, but if I just make that final run to the end, I'm probably still a couple of chapters short. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, there's lots of story to tell, and there's lots of little side roads to head down. And we'll just see where this lands. It's really been fascinating to watch all of this work out, because, surprisingly enough, we've been landing right around those 150,000 word mark, 160,000, just pretty consistently. So, you know, we'll just get the last two books done here and say what needs to be said and move on.
Anyways,
so that's good. Of course, starting this weekend will be in August, and I'm at 117,000 words now, and August should give me another 40,000 words. at least. So that's 157,000 words. It's right in the ballpark for where we need to be. So fine and dandy. Costuming is going well. I'm certainly not going to be early with Mr. Potato Head, but I don't think I'm gonna be late unless my little printer gives out, which it's just been printing away. it's printing away right now. So the latest print I think is going to be done at 6 or 7 tonight, and then I have a 2-hour print to do after that, and the second Mr. Potato Head foot should be done. Then once I get that second foot done, I can actually start, while other things are printing, I can actually start configuring that foot to function, because I've got to get a coping saw and like cut a hole in the top of the plastic and put some padding in there so it doesn't scrape up my foot. And then I've got to get some house shoes or something that I could put in underneath the plastic cover and get them secured, and like that and like that and like that. It's interesting because the foot was the first kind of big major multi-cut piece that I tried to do. I'm at 71% on the current print of piece number 5. There are 6 pieces altogether, and I have a total of 3 hours to go. So at 7:40, you know, that should be done. No, 5:40. Do the math, Phil. And then I have a little over 2-hour print, so that would take me to 7:40, 8-ish, sometime in there, and I could get that one started, and then I get something else started before I go to bed. So, you know, I think we're doing good. All that's fine. And it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun. I have structural things to work out, because the Mr. Potato Head shell, which is the front half and the back half that, you know, kind of push together, there are tabs that guide that pushing together, but it's not really a pressure fit. They do fit together and it guides it together, but what I'm going to do is attach magnets edge to edge on the two pieces, so that when I put them together, I'll get enough attraction there that it'll hold it in place and the tabs will stabilize the up and down motion. So that should work. And the nice thing about the magnets is I can double them up or triple them up. I'm gonna have like 12 attachment points with the magnets, and so I have to size them correctly, because I'm going to be crawling into the back half of it and then placing the front half in place, but then I have to be able to push out that front half to get out of it without too much struggle. And if magnets are too strong at 12 points, I'm never going to be able to get the thing pulled off. So, you know, all these things have to be balanced out. I jokingly told a friend that it was kind of similar to an Iron Maiden, because I'm going to be inside this shell and then people are going to be pushing in pieces that have rods on them. So I have to work out all that, where those rods are going to go, how long they have to be, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I've got to work out how to store all the pieces in the back that I'm going to store in the back for both Mr. Potato Head and Mrs. Potato Head, so people can arrange things as it goes. But you know what? Starting tomorrow, I will have 2 weeks, but I think we're going to make this. So, I think. So, yeah, you know, we'll see. So, this coming weekend is going to be Sunflower Day. I talked about that last week. And then the next weekend is International Cat Day. And then the next weekend will be Mr. Potato Head. So, I'm hoping all of that will go fine, but I have enough of it done now that you can kind of see the vision for it. So, and it's going to be cute. It's just working out the details, but God is always good to help me with those details. You know, I just keep stumbling forward, and then I get the right ideas at the right time. And, you know, I was planning kind of to do the magnets a whole different way, and then Jesus just kind of whispered, about, well, you can put them end to end and just tape them right onto the inside and they'll just do the thing. And I was like, oh, yes, I could do that. So gonna give that a try. I think it'll work fine. But anyways, so that's that. So work is good. Writing is good. Costumes are good. My poor beloved. I felt so bad Sunday morning for her. Because we went down to Branson and we had a nice day on Saturday. We went down to Branson and got checked into our hotel and ran back into Branson. We did the Disney Interactive Experience, which is cute. If you have little kids, it would be just great for little kids. It just would be fabulous for little kids. Because you watch the previews and you get this idea that you're moving from room to room and there's all these different exhibits and stuff, and that's not what it is at all. It's this big rectangular room that has white walls, or maybe light gray walls, probably light gray to increase the contrast. And then there's just a gajillion projectors in there. And they're all synced together, overlapped, so there's no seams. And they just are playing different Disney movie songs and different clips. And, you know, there's not really any theme or anything like that. It's just, you know, you're in there listening to Disney songs. And then they have these projectors that also project down onto the floor. And so you've got patterns happening on the floor. And I think the carpet was like some kind of gray. It was hard to tell because they could saturate the colors on the carpet pretty well. And then there's also sensors so that as you're stepping around, they can actually make the projectors react to you stepping around on them. So like when you first get in there, there's a bunch of leaves on the ground that are just projected, and then when you step around, the leaves kind of spray out from where your foot is landing. And it's very cute. It's very, very cute. And people, you know, with little kids just seem to really enjoy it. And then there's a bunch of benches, and the benches can turn all different colors. And at one point they have bubble machines that send a bunch of bubbles into the room. And we could have done just fine with just the base tickets, but I went ahead and invested an extra $9 for Annette and I to get the interactive experience, which consisted of a wristband that had two LEDs in it, and the LEDs lit up with different colors during different sections of the show. And I thought, okay, interactive experience. Because when they were talking about rainbows, there were all kinds of colors these two LEDs were turning. It was like, great, terrific. So it wasn't quite what we were expecting, but we enjoyed it. It was fun. That was Saturday. And then Saturday evening, we went to see The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is down through August. And it was very well done. It was very faithful to the book. Kind of a half puppetry, half human type thing. It was live action with some of the live actors playing like birds and different things. And it reminded me somewhat of what they were trying to accomplish in The Lion King. And certainly Aslan was, you know, this multi-person puppet. And you know what? It was very respectable all the way around. They made some interesting choices, like for Aslan, they had made this kind of giant puppet that there was three or four guys who were operating it. And they did a good job operating it. But for some reason, they dressed the guys in pants that were not solid black. They were solid black that had like reflective diamonds on them. And I wasn't sure, because that made the legs very noticeable. I wasn't sure the logic of that, but you know, aside from that, it was good. It was worth going to see. And it was a valiant effort. I mean, they were faithful to the book. They had some really nice scene change choreography, some really nice use of sets. and things and fun to watch. So yeah, worth seeing. So if you got a little extra time and you want to go see Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it's worth seeing. I was a bit dismayed that they had been going for a month and the theater could probably hold, I don't know, 1,000, 1,500 people. Probably, it was the old Lawrence Welk Theater, so maybe 2,000, maybe 1,500 people. I mean, it's a large theater, and there were just multiples of 100 there. There weren't really, you know, that many people there, which is kind of a shame, because it was done well enough that it would have been nice to see more participation. So at some point, Ned and I are going to run down and probably see David as well. You know, we have more time now to do those types of things. So then Sunday morning, we got up, and the plan was to get up first thing, go to Silver Dollar City before the heat was on the day, spend some time at Silver Dollar City, and then just go ahead and come back in. And so I kind of got up in my standard time of 4:30 to 5, and I did some writing, and I'd gone for a run, and packed up my stuff, and, you know, got into the car, and kind of got up, and she was bustling around doing some things, and it got to be kind of close to time when we were planning on leaving, so she got stuff finished up, and then she was just hurriedly trying to put all this stuff in her bag and get that taken care of, and she spun around at one point because she picked up a cord and she was just going to put it in her bag, and the toe of her shoe, her rubber shoes, caught on the floor because the floor was just a linoleum, which I really kind of liked that, you know, not a lot of carpet that just absorbs all kinds of things, and we were down at what's called the lofts at Indian Point. It's a very high and noble name. It's just basically an old motel that they renovated, but it's right near Silver Dollar City, and you're coming from the opposite direction as the rest of the traffic. So if you're going to go to Silver Dollar City and you're going to spend the night, the prices were reasonable. It was fine. No breakfast in the morning, none of that kind of stuff, but it was just good basic accommodations. And so we were there. And so Net spun around and her toe caught on the floor, and like just for a moment or two, I didn't quite know what was happening, and then I realized what was happening, and I mean, it almost looked like she was kind of doing a side soft shoe shuffle, like she was exiting stage right, and she kind of danced her way across the room and tilting farther and farther down as she was going, and then she just landed hard, and I mean it was not good because she caught the side of her body on the spike of the end table, you know, the corner of the end table, slammed into the floor, and this is like the second fall she's had in 2 or 3 weeks, and she, that fall was her left side and this fall was her right side, and so she laid there for a little while and, you know, kind of got up a little bit, but everything was hurting, and so I just told her, sweetie, let's just get packed up, let's go back up to Springfield, we'll see how you're doing when we get in the vicinity of Cox South, then we'll make a decision. Getting my mail, one moment. Oop. The little door on the back side of the mailbox has popped open, so I'm going to take care of that real quick here. I keep forgetting that I'm home early now and the mail isn't here. I'll get this all figured out. Eventually, I will get this in muscle memory again. Anyway, so we got up to Cox South, and, you know, as soon as she got out of the van, after sitting for a while, she went, ow! And it's like, okay, here we go. So, you know, I got a wheelchair out for her. We got her in patient transport. We got her in that, got her, you know, got her parked. I parked the car, came back in, took her down to urgent care, et cetera, et cetera. Thankfully, it does not appear that she broke anything, which is good. Which is good, because for a while there, she was having enough pain in her hip that I was thinking, weesh. And even urgent care said, well, you know, we don't use sophisticated diagnostics. All we do is just take a snapshot with an x-ray, and then we see. But, you know, it's possible they aren't very good resolution. It's possible that she's cracked something. So keep an eye on it. You know, if the pain doesn't go away in 2 or 3 days, then you might want to do something different and go into the emergency room and have them really do a full diagnostic on it. But yeah, she's bruised up pretty bad, and you know, just one of those things. So just a moment, there's just a moment is all it takes. So I am home, but I did come across a really interesting podcast it was by Tucker Carlson. And the name of the economist, who is a world-famous economist, he's a world-famous economist, and his name, just a second, let me just look up here real quick and see what his name is. His name is Werner, was it Werner? Oh, where's Spotify? There's Spotify. Tucker Carlson Show. And all episodes. Newest. Richard Werner, world-renowned economist. Really interesting discussion. And he has a long and storied history. He actually worked in Japan for several years, speaks fluent Japanese, you know, very intelligent man. And while he was in Japan, and actually I think while he was working on his doctorate stuff, he was puzzling over some of the things that he had seen in Japan and trying to make sense of what was happening in Japan economically. Because there was this consensus that Japan was on the verge of a prosperous era. And from what he saw, he predicted that they would be having a recession. He had done some work at the London School of Economics, but when he went to Japan, there were puzzles. So the Japanese stock market bubble, which was initially misinterpreted as a sign of productivity, everybody was saying that, no, Japan's just going to keep growing. He looked at it all and he said, no, this is a bubble and it's going to crash and affect the banking system significantly. And in fact, he published a discussion paper at Oxford warning Japanese banks were likely to go bankrupt, which contradicted the prevailing optimism about the Japanese economy. And they did, you know, suffer a recession. And so when he had proposed some monetary policy frameworks called quantitative easing, which might be a familiar term to you, which has been adopted by central banks worldwide, but they twisted it to their own purpose, and he feels like they're misusing that now. It was a very interesting discussion. But the one piece of this that really is fascinating is he had a theory. And he decided that he would run some experiments, and he, in his experiments, was attempting to show an oversight. And that is, he discovered what he felt like was the importance of bank credit creation, which has been largely overlooked in economic discussions. Said normally, They just don't talk about banks in economic discussions. And he thought that that was a mistake. So he thought that the banks, in fact, were playing a very, very important role. And he actually ran experiments to verify what he thought was happening at the banks, and he was proven correct. What he says are happening at banks, when banks give out loans, they are literally making money out of nothing. So we have this idea that the Fed runs the printing plants, and that increases the money supply. But, and that can be true, but by the same token, because we are in these fiat currency paper stuff and you can just add zeros to anything you want, what's really happening is when you have lots of little banks out there and they are just handing out loans for stuff, the more loans they're handing out, the more money is actually in the money supply, according to him. So, for instance, I go in and I apply for a loan. This is what he did. He went in and applied for some loans, like, I don't know, $20,000, something like that. He applies for this $20,000 loan. The money ends up in his account, but when you look across the bank's balance sheet, you didn't really see the movement of that money from anywhere else. It was just new money appeared in his account because the banks have this special form of deposits called, customer deposits that they are allowed to issue promissory notes against. But they're not really taking, they've invested those customer deposits wherever to invest interest and, to make money on bonds and all that kind of stuff. So they're all out there and that money is making money for the banks. But on the basis of the fact, if I've got this right, that the banks have that money available to them, they then add zeros to people's bank accounts without having to like pull those deposits and put them in a special place to say this money is spoken for and this money was transferred to these loan holders. In fact, that money isn't being transferred to those loan holders because the banks hold on to that money. They just, in essence, give customers like promissory notes that the customers are agreeing to pay back at a certain rate, and then the bank makes money on that interest. So his theory became that banks are actually money creation machines that are magic because of the way the regulations. And when he was in Japan, he published a best-selling book in 2001 called The Princes of the Yen, which explored the Japanese banking system and its prolonged recession. It was a very popular book in Japan, surpassed titles like Harry Potter. And he, went and through this book then started giving talks and things, and he has faced some opposition, and he was talking about how at one point Alan Greenspan in his career had actually mentioned this credit creation, bank credit creation thing, and then later he got a chance to meet Alan Greenspan. Alan Greenspan recognized him and said, bank credit creation, and then just walked off. And then there came a point where, for some reason, Alan Greenspan didn't want to talk about that anymore. And while he was talking about this, interestingly enough, after this, the summary that I've got says, after the success of his book in Japan, he faced challenges in getting it published in the U.S., encountering resistance for publishers due to political pressures. So there was some collection of somebodies out there that were just saying, oh yeah, don't publish that. And he actually received warnings from various sources, like the CIA showed up at his house to say, you know, we're watching you. Okay, what? And he had interest from multiple publishers. And then when he would send them the book, then they would go, no, we're not publishing this. He did end up taking out like a last chapter of conclusions. And then he did manage to get it published. And then he bought back his copyrights. And now it's Quantum Press or something like that. You can get it off his website. But he continues to discuss the fiat monetary systems and what they're doing and how they function. And it was just a really, really interesting podcast, and I would recommend it. Bitcoin continues to be fascinating. I'm reading and watching a lot of stuff on Bitcoin. And I think it was the New York Times were talking about how the major financial institutions, you know, are exerting their influence on Bitcoin at this point. And the Bitcoin normal processes do seem to have been disrupted somehow. Bitcoin isn't nearly as volatile as it used to be. It's still going up, but you're not seeing these, you know, 70%, 50% swings. What you're seeing is some drops, some gains, some drops, some gains, but overall it keeps climbing. And that probably will continue. I mean, I can't tell anybody what to do, et cetera, et cetera. I have no desire to tell people what to do. If Bitcoin can remain decentralized, this is what they always say, and I agree. If Bitcoin can remain decentralized, and if it can remain safe, you know, encrypted, that its cryptology cannot be cracked, it is so interesting and so unique. It's going to be really fascinating to see where this ends up. And it's fascinating enough that I would heartily recommend that people investigate it. Make the decision for yourself, but investigate it, because at this point, Bitcoin seems to have been accepted by major financial institutions as a store of value. Now, there are plenty of people on both sides of this argument. There are plenty of people who still believe it's a Ponzi scheme and talk about it being a Ponzi scheme. But there are also plenty of people who are economists and who are in charge of these massive companies and blah, 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 that will say, you know, I didn't get it at first, but then after reviewing and after looking, I realized that, you know, this, that, and the other, and ta-da-ta-da-ta-da-ta-da-ta-da. So, yeah. If you happen to have some disposable income and you're looking for some kind of store of value to put it in, at this point, there's really only a couple of places. You can put it into land. Land has been, will be a store of value. But the government you know, can seize your land by eminent domain. There's gold. The government has seized all the gold in the past. You know, and there's precious metals. I mean, you know, gold and precious metals. And then there's Bitcoin. And it is fascinating. It is just fascinating. So anyways, that's that. I have made it home. Have a great weekend, everyone.